Okay. So, today we're going to continue with the discussion of n equals 1 super QCD. And I'll explain to you conjectured cyber duality. The notes for the two lectures, these last two lectures, will be copied and made available. Probably they should appear sometime today. So let me recall this picture of the behavior of these theories as a function of the number of colors and the number of flavors. And the first thing was the theory was infrared free, IRF, when the number of flavors was greater than 3NC. And we had some sort of indication that it was in a fixed point, an interacting conformal field theory, when NF was greater than 3/2 NC. But things, we had evidence that things certainly broke down if we went to NF less than 3/2 NC. And what we want to do is sort of fill in this picture and give an accurate picture, at least of the vacuum structure of this theory for all values of NF and NC. So that's our goal for this part. So how are we going to make progress on this? The first thing to do is just to understand the classical theory. I'm not going to write out the Lagrangian again. We remember it's SUNC gauge theory with NF quarks in the fundamental and NF anti-quarks in the anti-fundamental representation of NC. Those were chiral superfields, which I called Q and Q twiddle. So we're doing the classical moduli space now, is what we're going to figure out. And this is just algebra. I take the F and D terms, if you like, from my classical Lagrangian, and I try to solve them. There are, of course, there are no F terms, actually, in this action, because there's no superpotential. All there was are going to be D terms from the gauge pieces. And you'll recall, presumably from Eric's lectures, that to solve the D-term equations, the general solution of a D-term equation is just made up of all the gauge invariant combinations of the chiral holomorphic gauge invariant combinations of the chiral superfields. So our chiral superfields were the quarks and the anti-quarks. Change notation on you. Keep them up and down like this. A was the color index, I was the flavor index. So I just have to make all gauge invariant combinations out of these things that I can. And then the set of all those gauge invariant guys is parameterizes the space of solutions to the D term equations. So what can we make? Things that we call mesons. And that's pretty simple. We'll just contract these guys on their color index, a quark and an anti-quark. And then we can make an independent invariant. Of course, I could multiply as many of these things together as I like, but I only have to, those are all algebraically related to this guy. So I only want to make the simplest objects out of which I can make everything else by polynomials. So the baryons, let's see. That will be something with NC flavor indices, completely anti-symmetrized. And that comes from just using the epsilon symbol on NC, on the NC color indices to contract a bunch of quarks. Okay. And then, of course, there's the antivariance. And that's just the thing with the downstairs indices, done in the same way with the antiquarks. Good. That's pretty simple. And I claim that any gauge invariant now can be made out of products of these guys. The reason, basically, is that I've used contraction, that's a delta function with one up and one down index on the color indices and these epsilons, and those are the complete set, or complete sort of generating set, of invariant tensors for the SUNC gauge group. Indeed, it almost defines the gauge group. So the moduli space, which I'll always be calling by curly M, is just going to be the space of these objects, the space of M's, B's, and B twiddles. We could count the number of independent components here, and we'd have a this many dimensional, complex dimensional space. But these guys are not all independent. There are generally some algebraic relations among them. I'll write down some of these for you. So I have to take this larger space and mod out by algebraic relations, equate points, which are on this general space, which are equated here. And that's the description of the classical moduli space. So what are the relations? Well, they're easy to write down some of the relations. What's hard is to write down sort of a minimal set which generates all the possible relations. But sort of the basic ones, for our purposes, will be the following thing. If you take a product of a baryon and an antibaryon, I haven't contracted any flavor indices. You can see it's going to be, you'll have two epsilons, but the product of two epsilons symbols, even with no contractions, can always be rewritten as some anti-symmetrized product of delta functions. So I can rewrite this, a product of baryons, in terms of an associated product of mesons. So if you work out the algebra, it's meson I1J1, product of NC of these guys, meson INC, JNC, anti-symmetrized on, let's say, it doesn't matter which pair set, let's anti-symmetrize on the upper ones. Okay? This is just an identity that comes from this identity I mentioned on the epsilon symbols. And then, actually, a simpler identity is the following one. If I take a baryon and multiply it by a meson, let me call this INC plus 1, okay, and I anti-symmetrize on all their upper indices, this thing must vanish. I'll write the 0 in a second. Why? Because when I anti-symmetrize on the upper indices, I'll have anti-symmetrized on this index as well as all of these indices, and therefore will automatically be anti-symmetrized on all these color indices. But then that will be NC plus 1 color indices, but the color indices only take values up to NC. So if I anti-symmetrize, then at least two of the indices have to be the same, and so it vanishes. So, and we can do the same thing with the antibaryon. I1 to INC, M INC plus 1, J anti-symmetrized is equal to 0. Good. So I have a whole set of algebraic relations, which I have to mod out by, if you like. Yes, right. That's exactly what I'm solving for here. When I say the moduli space, I'm asking what VEBs for the Qs, but we want to talk about it in gauge invariant terms. What VEBs for their combinations, for the lowest components of the chiral superfields satisfy the equations of motion or supersymmetric vacua? Well, those are the scalar components. Those are the only scalar fields in this theory. So the D terms give you a potential for the scalar fields, the scalar components. In general, that doesn't pick a unique vacuum. It allows you a whole moduli space of inequivalent vacua. Okay? I've just told you this result, which hopefully you've seen before, but I'm not proving it for you, that instead of having to write out the equations, the general answer, this is just true in general, is that to figure out what are the set of vacua, the zeros of this potential, all you have to do is write down all the holomorphic gauge invariant combinations made out of the chiral superfields. And think of these as their lowest component. Okay? That gives the answer to the D-term equations. Yeah? You can make operators like that, but that's not the answer to the D-term equations. Okay? Well, there's another issue, which is maybe what you're thinking of, which is you can try to ask, what are all the operators in the chiral ring? What are all the possible gauge invariant local chiral operators that you can write in this theory? That, indeed, you can insert gluons and so forth. But we're asking a different question here. We're just trying to parameterize the space of VEVs that satisfy the classical equations of motion. Yes? This is for arbitrary NF, arbitrary NC. Okay? I should have said, though, if the number of flavors is less than the number of colors, this thing is going to be automatically anti-symmetrized on NC flavors. Then, since if the number of flavors were less than the number of colors, this would automatically vanish. So these guys vanish automatically if NF is less than NC. Okay? So you can't even write down these the baryon guys if you have too few flavors, which actually simplifies the analysis for fewer flavors. But for general NF and NC, this is what you have. Here are some relations. This is almost the complete set of relations. This almost generates all the relations on MB and B-twiddle, except there's a certain sort of branches of the moduli space when one or the other of B or B twiddle is zero, in which case these don't capture all the relations and you have to write others. And I don't actually know of a simple set which captures all the relations in this case. I mean, I could write down all the relations. I can write you an infinite sequence of relations which would capture them all, but I don't want to have to do that. So we'll actually stick to some simple cases where I don't have to specify the complete set of relations. But this is all in the classical theory. This is just algebra. So let's look at some simple cases. Let's start, as I said, with NF less than NC. So what is the moduli space going to look like? There are no baryons at all. They're just the mesons. If the number of flavors is less than the number of colors in this, then there are actually no relations on the mesons themselves. Right? This is a general rank NF matrix. So there are no relations. And so the moduli space is just the space of all meson fields. And there's NF squared components here. So just as a complex space, it just looks like an NF squared complex dimensional space. So in pictures, it's just this featureless complex space. Of course, so maybe we should ask, what's the physics on this space? So typically, if you're at a given point here with a generic expectation value for this meson field, what's happening is the Higgs mechanism, and you typically Higgs the gauge group down to SU NC minus NF. Okay? So that's what's happening. That's the classical description. Since there are these extra light gauge degrees of freedom, at least classically, if I had computed, say, the Kähler potential in perturbation theory, then we'll find metric deformations, and there'll be these cusp-like singularities and stuff that we mentioned in our earlier lecture. But let's just focus on the complex structure of this space. And this is it. What else can we say? Okay, let's, enough for that. Classically, there's not much more to say for this guy. Let's go to this case when NF is equal to NC. That's the first case in which we can have a baryon. It's useful to define a dual baryon, B star, which is just found by contracting the flavor indices. Well, NF is equal to NC, that's why I can do this, of the with an epsilon, the symbol in the NF flavors. Since NF is equal to NC, that completely contracts all the flavor indices, and we're just left with a scalar. That's to say, because when NF is equal to exactly NC, even though this looks like a tensor with many components, since it's completely anti-symmetrized, there's actually only one independent component. And similarly, you can do the same thing for a dual antibaryon. So what does our moduli space look like? It's going to be the space of these meson, you know, these NF squared mesons, a baryon, the dual baryon and a dual antibaryon, which would be an NF squared plus 2 complex dimensional space. But plugging into these relations here, it's not hard to see that the only relation that we're left with is the following one. The point here is if I contract these guys with their epsilon symbols to make the dual baryons, I contract these guys with epsilon symbols, and that's just the definition of the determinant of M. So there's this one relation. Let me call it determinant of M is equal to 0. Let me call this, let me just give this a name, Y. So mod out by the ideal generated by Y. Okay? So there's one sort of relation on these NF squared plus 2 coordinates. So it's going to be an NF squared just plus 1 dimensional moduli space. But it's not just a featureless complex space, because we have to ask whether there are any singularities. Right? This picks out, if you like, this is a large space, and this picks out one relation. So it picks out a complex kind of hyperplane, hypersurface, given by this equation in this space. But it could be a singular space. When if I, the solutions of an equation could have a singularity. When do they have a singularity? So it has a singularity in the complex structure, to be precise. Well, when y is equal to 0, that just keeps us on the surface. And when the normal derivative, when the gradient of y vanishes as well, telling us that the normal vector to this surface fails to be well-defined. So if there's a simultaneous solution to these equations, the d here just means the total derivative. Independently, the partial derivatives with respect to each coordinate, right? B star, B twiddle star, and each component of m. So there is, turns out, there is a solution to this equation. So there is a singularity on this space. Where is it at? The singularity is when b star is equal to b twiddle star is equal to that m times m inverse ij are all equal to 0. Okay. This object, I've written it like this. This is just a shorthand for the subdeterminant of rank 1 less of m. In other words, if you wrote out the definition of determinant of m in terms of components and multiply it by m inverse, you can cancel, it turns out, the m inverse. And it's really a polynomial in this case, nf, which is nc minus 1 powers of m. So it doesn't depend on m inverse, even though I've written it this way. Okay. So this is some condition. It determines some sort of subspace, if you like, of the total space here. And it has a singularity. Yes. You can ask, are there some points in M for which this is true? This is just, this condition here is the condition. Yeah, that just tells you that the rank of, this just tells you that the rank of M has to be less than, to satisfy this condition, has to be less than NC. So less than or equal to NC minus 1. Do I have that right? Less than NC minus 1. So less than or equal to NC minus 2. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. OK. So there is a that's a submanifold of this total space where the rank, where these two vanish and the rank of this guy is less than NC minus 2. That's a singular space. So we can make a kind of a cartoon. What the heck is this thing? Of what such a space would look like. I mean, I really can't draw it because it has too many dimensions and everything. But just to give you a sort of a picture of it, in the total space of the M's, the B's, and the B twiddles, it's some submanifold like this, but it has a singularity. Okay? Think of it as the singularity is like something is pinching off. It's like the tip of a cone or something like this. Okay? So this is what we're going to think of as this classical moduli space. This is just a cartoon, but just to give you an idea of what we're talking about here. Okay. And you can also ask again, what's the physics? And generically on this space, for generic points on this moduli space, what's happening is you're Higgsing the gauge group completely. So this is just has no gauge group. This is just the sigma model as the low energy effective theory with, you know, just bosons and fermions. Except at this singularity is where, since the rank is at most 2 less than NC, what the Higgsing actually at best just breaks it all the way down to SU2, but no further. So there's always at least an unbroken SU2 gauge group at this singularity. Okay. This is again just the classical picture. So let's continue. The next case here, NF equals NC plus 1. This case is nice because it turns out in this particular case, these two constraints are still the complete set of constraints. So again, it's useful to dualize. So B star I is now epsilon I1 through INF times B I1 through INC. So there's, so this is this I is which, whatever, the NF I here, right? Because there's one, NF is NC plus 1, so there's one more index down here than upstairs. So I can dualize this to just a vector in flavor space. And similarly, you can do the same thing for the antibaryons. So now we see we have NF baryons, NF antibaryons, and again, the NF squared mesons. And now you can figure out what the constraints are. And it turns out there's two constraints. And let me write them out for you, because we're going to need them later. Again, this is this subdeterminant, so there's really no M inverse in this expression. And then from the second constraint, there's now a non-trivial constraint, which will tell us that the M's dot the B's vanish, and similarly for the B twiddles. OK, so these are the set of constraints. Again, you can ask now, are there singularities? There are singularities. So you, again, vaguely get a similar sort of picture. you have a generic moduli space where the gauge group's completely Higgs, but there will be complex singularities where the gauge group is enhanced. Okay? Okay. And I could do the same story for NF greater than NC plus 1. Now, the structure in terms of constraint equations and so forth is more complicated, as I said, but the general picture is the same. Okay. Good. So this is our review just of the classical physics of N equals 1 super QCD. So the next thing to do is to try to analyze what happens quantum mechanically. Yes? These are the relations from the D-term. All that I've been doing here is solving the D-term equations. Well, first of all, the flavor symmetry is a global symmetry. So if you have two vacua which are related by a flavor rotation, they are still two distinct vacua. They might have equivalent physics, just related by a flavor rotation. So here it's obvious that not all the vacua can be in the same orbit, because there's some distinct physics at some places compared to others. So in this picture, the flavor orbits are like these circles, but there's still many. Every point is a distinct vacuum, and the physics can change dramatically. It's just completely different. It's not related by a global symmetry in some directions on the moduli space. Other directions, of course, are related by global symmetries. It's not at all like non-supersymmetric theories, where you have no reason for expecting vacua which aren't related by symmetries to be degenerate. In supersymmetry, this is what we have, these moduli spaces of inequivalent vacua with completely inequivalent physics. Okay, so we need to start somewhere. And with 20/20 hindsight, I will start at the best place, which turns out to be NF equals NC plus 1. Why? Well, we'll see. It turns out to be sort of the perfect dividing line between two different regimes of physics, and we can handle it completely. So let's go back to NF equals NC plus 1 classically. And what are we trying to do now? We're trying to understand what's happening quantum mechanically. My goal essentially is to write down an effective action in the far infrared. Okay? But this is an asymptotically free theory. It's getting strongly coupled as I go into the infrared. So why should I believe these classical computations? Well, or another way of putting it, I need some guidance to guess what I think are going to be the light degrees of freedom that I should use to describe the theory in the infrared. So there's a nice thing that's happening in these cases where we have these moduli space of vacua in which the generic vacuum is completely Higgsing the gauge group. Because if this is an asymptotically free theory, and if I Higgs it at a very large VeV, right, that corresponds to Higgsing the theory at a very high scale, right? What it really says is that the Higgs mechanisms gives large masses to the vector bosons upon breaking it. And so since they're at large masses, that's at a high scale, where since it's an asymptotically free theory, it's very weakly coupled. So if I go far out in these directions on this classical moduli space, the classical description of the physics is getting better and better, because all the classical physics was the Higgs mechanism, and the Higgs mechanism is taking place at weaker and weaker coupling by asymptotic freedom. Okay? So this is a clue that I can believe the description of the moduli space way out, at least for large sort of values of MB and B-twiddle. Okay? So it leads to the following guess. There's a jump from this argument to the following guess. We will guess that this set, n, b star, and b twiddle star, I guess. Let me put in all the indices here. Are good, low energy degrees of freedom. I'm making the stronger guess, it's the complete set of low energy degrees of freedom. Okay? So you can ask whether this is justified or not, but it will be justified self-consistently. Okay. So what do we do? So let's try to write down an effective soup. So we're saying the ultraviolet theory was this gauge theory. The infrared theory, there's no gauge theory. They're just a bunch of chiral operators. These are all gauge neutral ones. So I'm saying that the ultraviolet theory was a gauge theory. The infrared theory is just some effective theory of some scalars and spin a half particles. Okay? It's kind of like a pion theory or something like a supersymmetric version of it, a sigma model, as we say. So what can you write down? There'll be some Kähler terms for these chiral superfields, plus at leading order, the most important thing would be a superpotential. So let's try to see if we can figure out what the effective superpotential must be. Well, it's got to be a holomorphic function of m, b, b twiddle, and lambda. Right? Lambda is whatever the strong coupling scale is. It's holomorphic by our supersymmetric selection rule. So let's see what we can. Now let's use symmetries and selection rules from broken symmetries to see if we can further constrain this function f. And now we will claim that we'll be able to determine it completely, well, up to an overall factor. Okay. So the first thing are the global symmetries. We have to remind ourselves, what were some of the global symmetries? Well, there were some unbroken global symmetries which were pretty obvious, which was just we could rotate the q's and the q twiddles independently. So we had an SUNF acting on the q's and an SUNF twiddle acting on the q twiddles. So these guys transform as a vector under this SUNF, as a fundamental, and then this one as a fundamental under the other SUNF, and this one transforms as a bifundamental, a fundamental under one with respect to these indices and under the other with respect to the other indices. Because if you remember, these were the indices from the Q's and from the Q twiddles or something like that. So I think I actually said that wrong. I've forgotten which one of my Q's and my Q twiddles. But if this was the flavor index of a Q, then this is actually the flavor index of a Q as well. It's raised because we use the epsilon symbol. So I can contract the upper indices of B's with the lower indices of M's and the upper indices of M's with the lower indices of B's. But I can't contract the upper indices of B's with the lower indices of B's because these are really in different global symmetry groups. Transform differently under the global symmetry. So, but let me try to make all the global symmetry invariants that I can make out of it. It's not too hard to see what they are. So remembering that I can't contract the upper indices of M with the lower indices of M, because these are the SUNF twiddles and these are the SUNFs, the only thing I can make, invariant I can make just out of M's is the determinant of M, where I use the epsilon symbols to contract them. So one invariant is the determinant of M. And then out of B and B twiddle, I could contract them, or I can put, the other thing I could do is put an M in between them, so I can get a B star and B twiddle star. I'm using a matrix notation now to get rid of these indices, okay? Is there any other, okay. So, that was one, and I could have also, no, that's, I'm sorry, that was it, right? I can't contract this guy with this guy and preserve this global symmetry. There's also a U1 baryon number symmetry, but that's actually automatically preserved by these combinations, so I won't bother to write it down. Okay, so these are my invariants. There are some other symmetries that I can write down, which are a little less obvious. There's an axial U1 symmetry, which is anomalous, and there's an R symmetry, and as we mentioned in a previous lecture, you can make a combination of the U1, of the axial with the U1R to make a non-anomalous version of the U1R. So that's what I'll write down here. So let me just remind you how these guys acted. So the axial symmetry gives this, has the Qs and the Q twiddles transforming with the same charge. And I'll write down the, this is in terms of the ultraviolet stuff, the W is invariant. And then you find that the strong coupling scale transforms. That's due to the chiral symmetry, chiral anomaly, I meant. And for the U1R, there was some formula here, which I will repeat. In our particular example, these factors of NF minus NC are just 1, since we're at NF equals NC plus 1, but I'm keeping them in here. The W has to have charge 1 under U1R, and then this was non-anomalous. Okay, so now we can figure out then what is therefore the charge under these symmetries of determinant of M. Well, determinant of M is just NF factors of M, and M was a Q and a Q twiddle, so it's NF of these guys and NF of these guys, so it has a total charge 2NF. Okay? And similarly here, NF factors of this guy, NF factors of this guy, so its R charge is just 2. Good. And then the other guy was our B star dot M dot B twiddle star invariant, and we'll do the same. We can do the same counting here. So we get 2 times NC plus 1 if you do it, because if you remember, the Bs have NC and M has 1 Q, so there's NC plus 1, and same for the Q twiddles, so we get this. But of course, NF is equal to NC plus 1 in this particular case, so these guys actually have the same U1A charge. And then we also have to compute. In this, likewise, putting these guys together, I'll leave this as an exercise, you get 2 NC plus 1 over NF times NF minus NC. And again, in this case, NF is equal to NC plus 1, so this is just 2 and 2 in our case. So, very nice. So now we learn from the non-anomalous R symmetry, well, the effective superpotential, remember, had to have R symmetry plus 2. This has R symmetry plus 2, and this has R symmetry plus 2. So what we must have is that the effective superpotential is just some linear combination of determinant of M plus B star dot M dot B twiddle star, okay? At the same time, now we can look for the selection rule under this broken symmetry, but we make a selection rule by assigning a charge to lambda b, and we see that for every factor of determinant of m, we have to divide by a factor of lambda to the b to cancel this charge. So that tells us how the lambdas must come into this action. So here we've determined the possible effective superpotential up to 2 complex parameters, alpha and beta. Well, this looks bad. We have the strong coupling scale in the denominator, and you would say that, well, this should be compatible with the weak coupling limit. This is an argument we actually used before when we were just moving down a little bit in the renormalization group. The in the weak coupling limit is setting lambda to zero in an asymptotically free theory. And so this would blow up, and you'd say, well, that's wrong, and therefore, you would say that the effective potential, let me put a question mark next to this, because it's going to turn out to be the wrong answer, it must be zero. This is not allowed. It's not compatible with taking the weak coupling limit. And in particular, this would then say that since there's no corrections to the effective potential, then the result for the classical moduli space must have been right. But this doesn't quite fit together, because actually we made an assumption that the low energy degrees of freedom were not MB, B twiddle modulo that the classical constraint. I just let us have arbitrary MB and B twiddle. And if the superpotential really is zero, this would tell us that if with this assumption that the low energy moduli space is not this manifold with this singularity, but it's just the more general space with no constraint. So it doesn't look like this is working. However, there's a loophole in all of this. If we look at the constraints that we had here, the constraints implied that let's do the following thing. Let's look at this first constraint. Let's stick an MIJ between the two, contracting them with the B and the B twiddle. And then the M cancels the M inverse. And we find that the constraint implies that B star dot M dot B twiddle star is equal to determinant of M. So if we set, so let's get rid of this. We note that if we set alpha equal to minus beta, then W effective vanishes on the constraint surface, on the classical moduli space. Okay? So this might be a loophole. So that if we set alpha equal to minus beta, then the fact that this diverges is not a problem, because it's actually multiplied by zero. It has some bad behavior off the moduli space, but it doesn't matter. It's constrained to zero there. Well, if this is going to be consistent, well, the effective superpotential with alpha equal to minus beta as its equations of motion better imply the constraints themselves. This is just that combination vanishing was just one result of the constraints. But in somehow the full constraint set, this full set of constraint equations should come out of the superpotential, right? So we can just test that. If this is true, then we calculate the constraints, the F-term equations, if you like, in this theory, which is you take the derivative of W effective with respect to M, set it equal to zero, and it gives some equation. Well, that equation, since this is an arbitrary MIJ, that just gives the first constraint equation here. I'm not going to write it out. Again, let me call these 1 and 2. This just implies equation 1, as it's easy to see. And do the same thing here. You take the derivative with respect to B twiddle, right? That's just going to hit this term. It's going to tell you that M dot B twiddle is equal to 0. And same for B star and B twiddle star. So this implies this. The second set of constraints. So it works. So let me erase here and just put a minus sign here. This superpotential, this guess for the superpotential is now consistent with everything that we know. The fact that the lambdas came in the denominator that was forced on us by this R symmetry, or I guess the anomalous axial U1 symmetry, told us that the non-perturbative effects are not allowed by matching to the weak coupling limit. And so our initial guess that the classical moduli space, at least was good asymptotically, has been transformed into the statement that it's true for all values of MB and B-twiddle. So that the quantum moduli space becomes the classical moduli space. And this effective superpotential actually gives you back the classical constraint equations. Okay? This, if you like, if you as a function of the VEVs, this gives you some potential, you know, found from the superpotential. And you know, here is our classical moduli space. I don't know how to draw it. It's supposed to be this whole in this multi-dimensional space. And this gives a potential. If you try to move off this classical constraint surface, it's just some potential like this. So it's kind of a potential with this valley. The valley has this funny shape, of course. And this valley, as we go to weak coupling, gets narrower and narrower. It constrains you more tightly to the moduli space. But that's actually what we expect. As you go to weak coupling, it's not a matter it's not a matter that you're allowed to fluctuate dynamically off this constraint surface. In weak coupling, this is simply an algebraic identity between your microscopic degrees of freedom. There are no fluctuations off the constraint surface. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It would not have the right R charge. This has no, lambda has no R charge, right? This was the anomaly-free R charge. This is actually a crucial symmetry that this theory had. You know, not every theory is going to have an anomaly-free R charge. So you're usually in good shape when you do have one. Yeah. Okay, that's great. That's the next question to ask. So what's happening here? Because if you expected classically, you got an SU2 gauge theory. And if you work it out classically, the resulting gauge theory is actually an asymptotically free gauge theory with no matter charged under it. And so you're saying, well, that's an SU2 Yang-Mills. It should flow to something we think it's going to be confining or something. So what's actually going on at this point here? Well, the simplest guess is that since this choice of field content worked in the infrared, maybe this singular point is just the point where in terms of the MB and B-twiddle modes, it's just saying that these extra fluctuations of MB and B-twiddle off the constraint surface are becoming massless there. So all it is a singularity in the sigma model, and there's no enhanced gauge symmetry. Well, how do we test that? This is just a guess. How do we know if this is right or wrong? Well, we can't prove it, but there are certain tests you can do. One thing you can do is something called a Tuft anomaly matching, and I'm not going to go into it here, but it's a straightforward test that gives a non-perturbative check. It's not necessarily a very strong check, but in this case, it's a non-trivial check that to see that you're that if you know your ultraviolet degrees of freedom, it gives you constraints on what the allowed choice of the infrared light degrees of freedom can be. And this choice, guessing that M, B star, and B twiddle star are the only light degrees of freedom, satisfies this Tuft anomaly matching condition. So I guess I should refer you to Seiberg's original paper on the subject to see that carried out. I'm sure many reviews also have it. I won't write the references down. You'll get a copy of these notes. Yeah. Okay. Right. So that's a good question. And so again, I guess I'm making a certain assumption, but actually you can weaken this assumption. And in my lecture notes, I actually weaken it to allow a diagonal breaking, the chiral symmetry breaking down to the diagonal SUNF. And you still find that these symmetries are enough just to pick out only these two operators. So in some sense, it's not allowed by the symmetries. There are some general theorems, I think due to Vafa and Witten long ago or something like this, restricting when you can have other kind, the possible patterns of chiral symmetry breaking in strongly coupled gauge theories. In any case, the attitude I'm taking here is this is an assumption, and we're going to try to check it. So let's go on and do some more checks of this thing. So what other checks can we do to see if this whole picture is consistent? What we can do is take this theory and perturb it by adding on a small mass term for some of the quarks, right? Then the same arguments will tell us that all, so we want to take the ultraviolet theory and put in a mass term, you know, like this, in the superpotential. So you do this. This remember, is another, this is a parameter in the superpotential. The effective action has to depend holomorphically on it. You do the same anomaly, the same, with the same assumptions, now you do the same considerations here. And so W effective becomes the same W effective we had before, plus a term. And it's not too hard to see what it must be, which is just this term. So, and this is certainly plausible in the limit that these masses are extremely small, but now we found them exactly, and so we just by analytic continuation, I know it for arbitrary masses. Now I'll let the masses get very large. Let's say a mass, let me just turn on, say, one eigenvalue of this mass matrix. That's microscopically, we know what that's doing. That's just giving a mass to one of the quarks. And we're going to make it very large, and we'll just, so once we make that mass much larger, say, than the strong coupling scale of the theory, we can just integrate it out in perturbation theory. So taking the limit that this mass is large and then solving for the F-term equations for the components of the M's, B's, and B-twiddles that are thereby set to zero or are fixed, we are just integrating out one flavor, and we should flow down to the theory with one fewer flavor, yes. Absolutely. I mean, we'll see an example in just a second where when we flow down, when we integrate out one flavor, so we get to NF equals NC, where there's not just, there's of course, like you say, there's just the spontaneous breaking, which comes from moving around specific vacua on this moduli space. But we'll also see an example of dynamical breaking. Yeah, the Goldstone bosons are tangential directions on this moduli space, the ones that take you along the orbits of the broken flavor symmetry group. So they're actually included in my low energy effective action, and that's why I don't see a singularity. At this point here, we had a singularity because there were components of MB and B-twiddle, this is something you'd have to check, that are becoming massless in this description, which are not tangent to the constraint surface. They are extra components. And that's why this can be a singularity in the effective action. Okay. So I need to speed up a little bit, I'm afraid. So let me summarize for you what's going to happen from this procedure of integrating out. It's a complete, this is just algebra. All we do is add this term to that superpotential that I wrote over there, and successively integrate out flavors. So that allows you to successively set to zero components of MB and B twiddle just by solving the F terms equations. And then in that way, you flow down from that theory to theories with fewer flavors. So it's just an exercise, and you should do it, or you can look in Seiberg's papers, and he does it fairly explicitly. So the answer from integrating out one flavor turns out to be a little funny looking. That's actually where some of the most surprising physics arises. You get this term. I guess I should put the stars here. Now, I'm being a little sloppy here. I'm using the same symbols, MB and B twiddle, as I used in the other theory, the theory with one more flavor. And I have this field X here. I'm using lambda to the B. Now, B has changed, and lambda has also changed. You have to do the appropriate one-loop matching when you're integrating out masses. So these are all the symbols referring to the fields in this theory, not in that theory. The relations are that this is some submatrix. NC by NC submatrix of that M over there, which was an NC plus 1 by NC plus 1 matrix. And similarly here, this is just one component of that vector of Bs that was over there. Remember, in this theory, these are scalars. I mean, one component, whereas there were NF component Bs. X is just one of those components, actually. It's kind of like, so if this was M for the NF equals NC plus 1 theory, then I break it up like this. This X is that component of this guy. Okay. In any case, this is the answer that you get. What does it tell us? Well, X appears just linearly in the superpotential, so it acts like a Lagrange multiplier. It simply enforces this constraint. And the interesting thing is, I guess I've erased it, is that this constraint is not the classical constraint. Instead, the classical constraint wouldn't have had this term here. It would have had det M is equal to B star B twiddle star. That would have, without this term, that would have given us this kind of picture. But now we've deformed this constraint surface a little bit. It's only important here in the middle. You can now check, are there any singularities in this resulting surface? There are no singularities. What it does is it smoothed out this singularity into a kind of a throat region here. So you have a nice smooth picture. This is an example of a dynamical chiral symmetry breaking in the sense that whereas classically there had been a spot where the chiral symmetries were unbroken, quantum mechanically these sort of instanton type corrections have resolved this singularity, and there's now no vacuum in which chiral symmetry is restored. Okay? So if this is the first time you've seen it, this should be surprising behavior. It was to everybody else. I should have said, of course, there's an overall undetermined coefficient here. I'm going to write down the correct value for this coefficient. And I have to be a little specific exactly about what some conventions are, but the correct value is 1. So I know this actually by the result of some of this integrating out procedure and matching to some other known results. So I'll write the correct coefficients here. If I integrate into out more flavors, so as NF is less than NC, okay, I guess, but I don't integrate all the flavors out, I get the following answer. Here, there are no baryons left at all, as we knew classically. So it's just in terms of the determinant. And so what is this? Nc minus Nf. You get this funny effect of superpotential. Well, I'll get there in a second. What is this telling us? Well, there are a couple of interesting things about this. First of all, now the non-perturbative corrections are coming in the numerator, which is the right place. The funny thing is they're coming with fractional powers, except for when NF happens to be NC minus 1. Then that's a one instanton correction. But for all the other values, it's a fractional instanton correction. Well, one good thing is in the one instanton case, when NF is NC minus 1, it still turns out that that the generic vacuum completely Higgs's the gauge group. And so you can actually, at large Vev, if you like, do the one instanton computation reliably, because you have a Higgs Vev to cut off the infrared divergences in the semi-classical calculation. And then you can actually match that calculation to this answer, and it matches. And that's one way of getting this coefficient, though actually there's some subtleties in actually getting this calculation right. But in any case, the one instanton case matches. So that's reassuring that we're on the right track. What does it mean that as we go to fewer flavors, we get fractional instantons? Well, semi-classically, fractional instantons aren't allowed, right? Instanton numbers are quantized. But where does that come about? That's because we restrict ourselves to, in the path integral, if you like, to field configurations which are continuous. But this is a question. What are the right field configurations that has to do with, you know, the measure of the path integral? And if we're getting, apparently, when we're becoming more and more strongly coupled, as we have fewer and fewer light flavors in these theories, the fluctuations are just getting worse and worse. And they're allowing field configurations, which you would say were disallowed semi-classically, but we're far from the semi-classical regime. Well, one worrisome thing might be that can't we go out to large Vevs, and then won't we be weakly coupled there? And then we would have expected the semi-classical regime to be correct. But this is a very different looking potential. If I figure out what the potential is, as a function of values of m. Really, I guess I'm plotting something like determinant of m here. It's a potential which has this sort of runaway behavior. It has no minimum. I mean, it's bounded below, but it never reaches its minimum except out at very large, as the m goes to infinity. So it has this sort of runaway potential, but it just tells us that there's no vacuum. I think I misspelled vacuum. Whatever. okay. A new behavior of these theories, which was also surprising back in the 80s when it was first proposed. It seems consistent with everything that we know. Okay. There's something else. Oh, and of course, since there's no vacuum in particular, it certainly lifts the classical moduli space. This was a whole space of vacua, and now there are no vacua. Okay, yeah. Right. What should be equivalent? What can I say? I don't see the inconsistency, let me put it that way. You've generated in doing so. This is not to say that for large Vevs, these degrees of freedom are still getting arbitrarily light or something like that, right? So there's simply no stable vacuum of the theory, but there must be some sense, I mean, at least the way to think about it is that there is some sense in which for large M, this theory is still well approximated. by this choice of like degrees of freedom. The fact that it's, of course, not at all well approximated here doesn't really matter. Because of the holomorphy of the superpotential, if we have a region in which we can get the right answer, then we can just analytically continue in. In some sense, that's what we're doing from the, that's why I started at NF equals NC plus 1, where we had this nice answer which matched on to the classical moduli space. And then I could just integrate out masses using analyticity. I could integrate out all the masses and ask what happens. So then I can go to NF equals 0. This is the super Yang-Mills theory. And what do we get? You should do the exercise. You can take, let's say, this thing with NF equals 1 and add in a mass term for the M is just now, has no indices, and just add in the mass term for M and integrate it out. You get, with these appropriate coefficient here, which is another way of determining the coefficient, you get NC discrete vacuum. So the potential now has minima, and it turns out to have NC of them. And this actually matches to the Witten index calculation for the SUNC super Yang-Mills theory, which told us that the Witten index, as computed by Witten back in the 82 or something, gave us NC, which was a strong evidence, I guess, that there are NC supersymmetric vacua for this theory. So that checks. And the whole thing forms in this way a consistent picture. We can sort of fill in this blob. NC discrete supersymmetric vacua here. If we go from NC up from between here and NF equals NC, there's no vacuum. If we do NF equals NC plus 1, then there is a, for NF equals NC, there was then a whole moduli space of vacua, but the shape of the moduli space was corrected quantum mechanically. For NF equals NC plus 1, we found that it was the classical vacuum and the quantum vacuum coincided. And as you can guess, if you tried to do the same exercise for larger values of NF, you would always have these instanton factors are in the denominator. And so again, you can never lift the classical vacua. So in here, in general, you have this classical vacua, and you have singularities at the origin. This is true everywhere. That it's the classical answer here, that was kind of obvious, because the classical theory was actually free in the infrared. So we didn't have to do any work. There was nothing to flow down to. We were already in the infrared in the classical theory. Here, we had an argument that we would have an interacting fixed point. So it makes us guess that the singularity here might be a superconformal field theory. But below this line, we had evidence that this couldn't work. So this raises the question as to what's going on at the singularity here. And we just, and I, as I remarked before, in this theory, it was at least consistent to assume that the singularity here involved no new gauge fields or anything like that. We could just use the same sigma model degrees of freedom, the mesons and the baryon degrees of freedom, to explain it here. So maybe that's what happens here. But you try it, that is to say, you test it against the Etouffe anomaly matching condition, and it fails. So this is not just saying that it's NB and B twiddle are the light degrees of freedom at this singularity. Here must be wrong, and something has to change this story. And that's what Seiberg duality is. It's a guess for what are the right degrees of freedom at this point, a guess which satisfies many non-trivial consistency checks. So I just want to say, I keep on saying that there's a singular point, but you know, this is just a cartoon. These are multi-dimensional spaces, and this singular point is actually a sub-manifold, a sub-variety of this complex space, of some complex co-dimension, right? And it itself, that as a sub-variety, it itself can have further singularities and so forth. So it's just a, this is this, the language that's often used is people talk about the singular point or the origin of the moduli space, but that's a misnomer. There's, it's quite a, you have to have a, think multidimensionally somehow. Or just keep in mind that it's a bit more complicated than that. So we want to understand these theories. Or rather, the question we're claiming is just what's happening at the singularities in these theories. So these are NF greater than NC plus 1. And the answer, as I just said, is known as cyber-duality. So cyber-duality cannot be derived from these the field theory tools that I've told you about. And there might be some interesting using connections between gauge and gravity theories. There might be some interesting constructions in string theory, which might give you something like a derivation of these proposal. But within the field theory context, there's no known derivation. So the best way to present it is as a guess, as a proposal. So, right, maybe I should. This is in this paper. The proposal is that the new light degrees of freedom, the light degrees of freedom at this singularity are described by the following theory. It's going to be an SU gauge theory with NC twiddle numbers of colors, where NC twiddle is NF minus NC. Okay? So he's going to say that what's actually happening here is a gauge theory, but it's with a different gauge group than what you had, that you thought you had in the ultraviolet. And we're going to have NF flavors of some quarks, I'll call them little Qs, and also some anti-quarks, little Q twiddles. And let me, I guess I have to put the indices in the right place. Transforming in the fundamental. And in addition, he says, we're going to add in another field, looking something like a meson field, but this is supposed to be an elementary field in this theory. So it has NF squared components. And so these guys were, I should say, in the fundamental and anti-fundamental of the gauge group. And these guys are singlets of the gauge group, not charged into the gauge group. Okay, that's the proposal. Oh, sorry. There's one other thing. Plus a superpotential, right, which is of this form. I can make a gauge invariant and flavor invariant combination of these three guys. Good. This is the proposal. Let me now try to give you, or at least summarize, the evidence for why this works. The first thing to note, so what are the sort of the checks for this thing? It has to satisfy some tests. The most obvious is that the ultraviolet theory that we started with had a certain global symmetry group. So we should want this theory to have at least that global symmetry group. There might, of course, there might be accidental enlarged symmetries in the infrared, but well, there are various things that can happen, but that's a good check. So the global symmetries are the same because they're NF flavors, so we transform under an SUNF sort of left, SUNF right. There's a non-anomalous U1 baryon, and in this theory you can make a non-anomalous UNR charge. So it's the same global symmetries. The other thing is this Tuft anomaly matching works in this case, which might be one of the ways in which this field content was first derived by Seiberg. Or let's see, what else? What other things do we have? Well, we're trying to explain the light degrees of freedom here in the infrared. And you might complain that by describing it by a gauge theory, we're not solving the problem because this will be some gauge theory and it will have strong coupling. But we're talking about at least if the number of flavors, is less than 3/2 NC, then just doing the algebra, you see that NF is greater than 3 NC twiddle. That's just some algebra, if I did it right. And what does that mean? That this theory, so let me give a name for this theory. This is now in the literature called the Seiberg dual theory. And the original ultraviolet theory is typically called the direct theory. So we have a direct and a dual theory. So he says that the Seiberg dual theory is infrared free. So that's excellent. This is actually a free theory in the infrared. So it is a good description of the light degree, a reliable description of the light degrees of freedom near this singular point. It's also very surprising that you have an asymptotically free, the direct theory is an asymptotically free theory that goes through strong coupling, and we say we arrive in the infrared at an infrared-free gauge theory with a different gauge group. Very surprising statement. Doesn't contradict anything, but no one would have guessed it, I don't think. So there are other checks. These other checks are harder, and I'm just going to state what they are. We had a picture of what the moduli space was that had to do with these constraints and all that crap. Here we have another a description of the light degrees of freedom here. So it has its moduli space. If they describe the same theory, the figuring out what its moduli space is should coincide with the moduli space that we had from this theory. The two sets of flat directions, the two descriptions of the theory, should coincide, and they do. This is actually not an easy thing to show, and it's the arguments are a little subtle, but you can look in Seiberg's paper for at least an outline of them. Somewhat easier to show are that you can also make a mapping not just of VEVs, but also of marginal deformations, of the relevant deformations of the mass operators, mass deformations of the two theories. So that also works. I should say that when you match the moduli spaces, I should have given you the dictionary of, you know, here this moduli space was described by the MB and B twiddle fields. What do those have to do with the flat directions coming from this theory? Well, there will, again, the gauge invariants we can make will be sort of a dual meson and baryon operators. And in addition, there will be this extra operator. What's the map? So the mapping turns out to be as follows, that the dual baryon operator, right, is equal to the flavor dualized baryon operator in the direct theory. It's easy to check that these have all the same flavor quantum numbers and so forth. And similarly, the anti-baryon operator will be the dualized to the anti-baryon, the flavor dual anti-baryon number. Maybe I can just one thing to check, for instance. This is a baryon operator in SUNC twiddle theory, so it has NC twiddle flavor indices. The baryon operator in the direct theory had NC flavor indices. But when I contracted it with the epsilon tensor on NF indices, what were left were NF minus NC. So I have NFN minus NC anti-symmetric flavor indices here and here. So that's showing you that they transform in the same representation, if you like, of the flavor group. Similarly for here. And it turns out that this extra scalar has all the same global symmetry charges, like R charges as well, as the meson field. So there was also a dual meson field, the little q, q twiddle operator. What happened to those? Well, we have to, when we look at the moduli space of this theory, there's a superpotential here. So it gives some F terms. On that moduli space, the superpotential is just N contracted with little m, right? Because this is just little m here. Something like that. And let's look at what, so when I write down, it's not enough just to do my solution of the D terms to find the moduli space. There are also now going to be F term constraints from the superpotential. One of those constraints, at least, says that if I take its variation with respect to the field N, I'll get some equation of motion. And that one simply sets the dual meson field to zero. So this guy isn't a flat direction at all. It's always given a mass by that superpotential term. Okay. So now we've filled out this picture. So what's happening here is an infrared-free dual QCD theory. Of course, here, this is where the direct theory was infrared free. So we didn't have a problem with the description here. So here we have this dual description. And what happens here? Here we have two descriptions. And now, because where NF is less than 3NC, the direct description is asymptotically free. But when NF is greater than 3 halves NC, by that same argument, the dual description is asymptotically free. So we actually have two descriptions of the same theory in the infrared, but they're not direct descriptions. They're both as asymptotically free theories. So what's happening here is that we have two ultraviolet fixed point theories. This would be the direct theory, and this would be the Seiberg dual theory. And what the claim then is that under renormalization group flow, they flow in the infrared to the same interacting fixed point. And of course, there's certain things you can check about this, like certain anomalous dimensions that are protected by supersymmetry, but I'm not going to go into all of that. So this is an example of what you would call universality under renormalization group flow. There can be many theories in the ultraviolet that flow to the same theory in the infrared, and here's a proposal of two of them. So in this region, Seiberg duality amounts to the statement that the direct and dual theories are in the same universality class. Yes? Well, there's no derivation, okay? So all we're doing here is I'm giving you some evidence. I've claimed that these two theories have many things match up among them. They'll give rise to the same description of the moduli spaces. In the singularity in these two theories, I haven't described how, I'm sorry, but you can compute R charges, and from a relation that I mentioned earlier, you can deduce the exact anomalous dimension of certain operators in the chiral ring. They match between the two descriptions. The relevant deformations match between the two descriptions. It's the same sort of evidence that we have over there, except that in this case, it's not infrared free, and so we don't have a direct description in the infrared. But the what you can learn about what happens in the infrared matches. So this is the proposal. That's the nature of this subject. It's not a proof. But there is a strong, a very tight set of checks that I've just outlined for you here that makes us believe it. In fact, in some sense, I think in Aharoni's talks next week, you'll learn of a sense in which this set of correspondences has been extended to a much larger class of theories and has a corresponding gravity through the ADS-CFT correspondence, much corresponding gravitational version of these dualities. And it all works, you know, really fantastically. So there's really no doubt in anybody's minds that this proposal is correct, I would say. But it's not a proof. It's kind of a consistency argument. OK. Well, that's all I was going to say about, maybe I should, well, I guess I'm out of time. So let me just say two words. What other ways are there of generalizing this? You can certainly do this for other gauge groups, and many people have done this. And there's some pitfalls that can be met along the way. It's not for every gauge group that this works so easily. If you have group, for other gauge theories, depending on the matter content and so forth, you can have much less global symmetry, or you might not have non-anomalous R symmetries, and a lot of these arguments become much more shaky. You have much less evidence, and there have been examples where using a Tuft anomaly matching seems to say something is working, but then other things don't work, and it becomes clear that, well, it was just an accident that the Tuft anomalies matched. So there can be accidental Tuft anomaly matching. Other cases where you flow to the infrared and you may just have an accidentally enlarged infrared symmetry group that you didn't think about before. That's another pitfall. And in general, if you're not talking about QCD vector-like theories, but chiral gauge theories, very little is understood about these techniques are not very effective for guessing the strong coupling dynamics of those theories. And of course, another thing that can always happen is you could have dynamical symmetry breaking in a theory. And this is something which we have very little control over in the chiral gauge theory cases. The Witten index type arguments do not apply. What's that? Well, it depends on the matter content, right? No, they're not all infrared free, right? By a chiral gauge theory, those are theories in which a chiral theory. I'm not sure exactly. By a chiral gauge theory, I meant one which did not have an anti-quark for every quark. In other words, in which there are fields for which there are no mass terms allowed by gauge invariants, like electroweak theory, for instance. So that use of chiral had nothing to do with chiral superfields, like I was saying before. Sorry. OK. Next lecture, which I gather is this evening, I will talk about N equals 2 super QCD in cyber-Witten theory.